I'm gonna introduce Earl, who pretty much needs no introduction. He's been in our neighborhood for a long time, formerly the editor of the Bar Harbor Times, which is what he was doing when I first met him through the League of Women Voters, then the editor at the Mount Desert Islander, and then with Friends of Acadia, now retired to his train set. But I just love the way Earl thinks. He's got a brilliant mind, and it surveys the whole landscape. And when you get Earl, you always get something interesting to talk about. So with that, I'll take it away.
Thank you, Ann. It's, I don't know if I can live up to that billing.
Yeah, you can. You always do.
Thank you for having me today and to talk about some of the things, regardless of, you know, what I'm currently that I'm still pretty passionate about. Some things I'm actually quite distressed about when I just see kind of the level of journalism and what have you. And I think the last time we talked about this subject was about 20 years ago. And that was just after we had founded the Islander in November of 2001. And, you know, second only to restaurants at failure rate is newspapers as far as startup companies go. So the fact that the Islander this entire year has been celebrating its 20th anniversary, and it still cranks out and sells about 5,000 newspapers a week. And it's been kind of successful, and it was an interesting process as we went along. And I said I had left the Bar Harbor Times because after the third buyout, every new set of investors or purchase and new owners, they all think they're better business people than the last people. And they come in and they do their due diligence, and they realize there's no savings because the people before them weren't spendthrifts or anything else. But they think their hubris allows them to believe they're so good that once they get in there and kick the tires, they'll find some savings. And when they realize they can't, then they start cutting things. And the first thing they cut, of course, is reporters, because they're pesky and they're a pain in the butt. They complain about everything. Mm-hmm. So when I was there at the Bar Harbor Times, and we'd gone through the buyout by the Texans, and then we went through the buyout by the guys from North Carolina. And 2 weeks in, they said, come on down to Rockland. We're going to have a meeting about what's going to happen next. And at that point, the Bar Harbor Times had a 40% profit. Mm-hmm. It was making $400,000 a year on a $1.4 million in sales. I mean, that's incredible profit margin. And so I went to this meeting, and they said, before you come in, you got to sign the secrecy pledge not to reveal what, you know, we're going to talk about. I'm like, all right, I'll sign that. So going. And they said, well, company-wide, Courier Publications at that time, which was Nine Weeklies, was doing about a 12 or 14% profit. The Bar Harbor Times was the most profitable arm of it. And they said, but the new investors have been promised 25. So we want you to take the weekend to think about it and then come back and tell us who the 2.5 people you're going to fire. So we hit that target this year. And I thought about it over the weekend. I called the publisher, Dave Morris, at the time, and I said, look, you know, you aren't even going to, with the profits you take out of this community, and you're not even going to put those jobs in there, and those people had worked for me for 10 years, and I wasn't going to lay them off. So I said, I'm going to save you one. You have my resignation. I'm done in a month. And he said, I'm with you. If I didn't have 80 jobs company-wide to try to save, I'd be quitting too, but I wanted to just save as many as I could. So anyway, so they bought it. Alan Baker heard that I had left. Matter of fact, he heard that same day, called me at home and said, I'd always wanted a paper down there, but he and I had been on a lot of regional boards and stuff together. And he said, but I knew you'd kick my butt. Yeah. And so he said, but what do you think now? So we had a brown bag lunch on the porch of the then Seacoast Mission, which is now the Historical Society of Bar Harbor, and decided to start the Islander. And so we started that up, and it did great. It was a lot harder than I thought. I figured that we sent it to everybody for the first 2 weeks free on the island. I figured, wow, the subscriptions will roll in that third week. We sold 1,000 copies. Mm-hmm. We got some work to do here. So anyway, it built up, and it got to be really great. The Bar Harbor Times was sold in a bunch of transactions and went to Village Soup. Mm-hmm. And then finally, they ended up just going bankrupt. And I said the irony was that by starting the Islander, I became the agent, not wanting to dismantle the Bar Harbor Times, but starting the Islander, I became the agent of its doom. Mm-hmm. in one respect on the poetic front. However, when that company went bankrupt and nine towns lost their newspapers, the island still had one. It was the Islander instead of it, but it still had that institution in the community. And so we thought that was pretty important. Now, that's gone through more transitions now. And I think that you'll see that trend towards greater consolidation, overhead. Some companies, they believe, well, we can share content. We only need one entertainment section. We only need one editorial section. Those types of things. The gentleman who now owns the Islander and the American, 23 weeklies in the State Read per Hour. Fortunately, he came through on the production side of the business and the advertising side. He's really not that all that interested on the editorial side. So that's great, because people worry with consolidation that you're going to be getting one editorial jammed on the throat of every community, and it's all going to be a political vehicle for someone. And that's actually certainly not the case, I think, with Reed, because he wants them all to have their own voice. However, it's getting harder and harder to make ends meet. And so you see consolidation, you see lighter staffs. I mean, halfway through the development of the Islander, Alan Baker, who was not known to be loose with a dollar, let me tell you, came to me and said, I think you need another reporter. I actually emailed everybody I knew, and I was on the board of the New England Press Association at the time, and said, when have we heard a publisher say that? You know, you need another reporter. So so I think that just for the fact that there's somebody in Maine you can call and owns those papers, Lisa DeSisto, who is a publisher now of all of his papers, who primarily focuses on the dailies, which is the Portland Press Herald, the Lewiston paper, the Waterville paper, the Augusta paper. She's a fabulous person that believes in print journalism. She doesn't believe that it's the death knell of it. And so she's a very strident champion of it. So I think that's in good hands there. And she has a lot of good marketing ideas. What have you heard? She was with the Boston Globe organization for years before she came up to Maine. But you have that responsiveness. You can call those people. I think particularly with the Islander, they went through change of editor just before COVID started. The new editor lives in Blue Hill, but working remotely, hasn't managed to kind of get those connections with the community. And it's harder for that, you know, to kind of pay attention. I was talking before this about, there was a recent article, like it was like 5,000 newspapers have shut down in the last few years. And at one time there were 50,000 newspapers in this country. It was probably about less than 20 now. A lot of those are dailies. You had towns that had afternoon dailies and morning dailies, and you know, competing papers, which made them much better. Most large cities now just have one paper, and sometimes they don't even publish every particular day. So I think you're going to continue to see that, primarily because there's no clear way forward for the newspaper business right now. It used to be, well, if we can expand our circulation, and every year we go up a few percent on the ads, and you know, if we need extra revenue, we do a special section. I mean, that's one thing the Islander and American were very entrepreneurial. We never knew how we were going to put together, but we ended the year profitable. But it wasn't, there was no formula, and it wasn't the same every year. You just had to hustle, live by your wits. And so it's harder now to do that. So I think you're going to see continued consolidation. I have no idea how long the Bangor Daily is going to be there. It's been a cry for help for I don't know how long. Their circulation, the last numbers I saw, was almost down to 20,000. When I was in college, they used to print the previous day's sale on the front page, and it was 106,000, 110,000. You know, they were, and now they're down to less than 20. They put all their eggs in the electronic online basket. They sold their presses, they got rid of them, because they believed at that time, 8 years ago, that within 5 years they'd be all digital. And now it's still the print product that pays the bills. Yeah. They don't make enough money from online ads to do that, and they can't afford all the reporters that they do have. They used to have a bureau in every county with a bureau chief and three or four reporters. That bureau chief knew what was going on, but then they moved all of the oversight and copy desks to Bangor. Then it became a game for the reporters. How little can I do and still get paid? Nobody knows what's actually going on down here. So I have great fear and trepidation, because it's almost to the point now where it's not worth anybody to pay for. You look at the Maine Sunday Telegram and the Portland Press Herald, when they were sold by Blethyn Maine Newspapers to that company out in Seattle, It sold for $200 million. And 6 years later, it sold for $1.5 million, and that included the building in downtown Portland. That's how quickly the numbers changed. It used to be you paid a certain percentage of gross and, you know, so many times earnings, and it so it just didn't work. That trend is worrisome. And I think now the thing that I worry about the most is the fact that, just like so many other things in COVID, people retired and got out of the business. And so you have younger reporters, less experienced reporters, and they really don't know what's going on. They don't know what a police docket looks like. They don't know what a town meeting agenda, they don't know how to read an annual report, much less follow the elections. And so, and I try not to be like the former editor, da, 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 but I send fake emails every once in a while. I say, you guys really ought to do something. This is going on over here. And I think, you know, that might not be a bad story for you guys when you get a chance, but it's harder for them to recruit, and especially in the island. Nobody could, no matter what they pay, you can't afford to live there. So it used to be with people at the lab and at the college and everything else, you had spouses that were pretty well educated and motivated that you get as reporters. I had somebody with a master's in library science answering the phones at the paper because they just thought it was great to work at a paper. But people can't afford to live there now. So it's really hard for them to recruit staff. Mm-hmm. And when they get somebody to, I mean, they keep calling me up all the time. You want to come back to work? You want to do this? I'm like, no. Sorry, mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. I'm working on some projects. I've been asked to do a column for the two papers, which I may start in the fall. We'll see about that.
Please do.
I kind of like to do it, kind of focus on people. So then the other side of the staff shortages is people do the low-hanging fruit. They do the easy story, the one that's in front of them. They get their hours in by knowing they can go to a 3-hour meeting or write a story, and then they're done for the day. That doesn't take any digging. That doesn't take any time to kind of do that kind of stuff. One of the things that dawned on me, and these are things that you all can do, is call them up and tell them when you see a story or you have an idea for a story. Ann mentioned that apparently John Linehan's house is for sale. Well, the old newsman in me goes, well, he's running for office. Where's he going? Yeah. Is he going to maintain his residency? Did he shift his legal address on all his campaign filings to one of his fly-by-night loan businesses instead of an actual residence? Yeah. So he's going to live in Florida. So, you know, that's what I mean. I would have a reporter go check on all of that. But somebody now has got to pretty much call the paper and suggest that, because they're not going to, you know, those kinds of things. So that's kind of the thing that I kind of worry about. The other thing is people are so worried about bias in media. Part of it is, I find in Maine, it's more of a lack of attention than it is deliberate bias. People, they've been running a lot of housing stories in the Bangor Daily News based on census data. And it's like, you know, 94% of housing were owned by, you know, white folks and all these other kind of things. But they never even say once in that article that it came from census data, which drives me crazy. So is it just the reporter saying all this stuff? Is it that? But there's no editor saying, hey, wait a second. And then even just vocabulary and word choice, they're just using the wrong words all the time. And it's just inaccurate and lazy, because there's nobody on the copy desk that knows how to blue pencil a story. Again, it's really difficult, and it's hard to kind of watch that. And I don't know necessarily what the answer is, but the public needs to demand more. You know, I have a lot of friends in the news business, and I think half the people I know at the Bangor Daily have asked me for references in the last couple of years, because they realize it's not a career move. It's interesting, they had approached me about doing a column, but they tried to blackmail me into doing it. I was working on my last book, Wild, Weird, Wonderful Maine, and they had 4 or 5 pictures in their archives I really wanted to use, but they charged $200 a piece. I wrote to the editor up there and I said, hey, you know, I'll give you guys credit and do some good exposure, but I can't afford to, because I'd have to pay that out of my own pocket. And then he gets back to me and said, well, you know, if you promise to write 4 columns for us, then we'll let you have those pictures for nothing. And I go, like, that's blackmail. That's not, you know, and I said, forget it. And I contacted some historical sites that different pictures. But and it's mainly because I just don't see that. It's selfish for me as a career move to write a column for the Bangor Daily News, because I don't think it's going to be that much.
Aww.
So I don't know if they'll get bought up. It makes sense for Reed Brower to buy them. You know, they get print in Portland. That's why you can't get your paper before 10 o'clock these days, because the truck goes in the ditch on the way up from Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, and they go to press at 9 o'clock at night, which means their deadline is at 5. That's why they don't have any news from the previous day in the Bangor. You know, even on big things, they may have a story we're expected to. So I think the other thing is bias, and there's a couple of great tools, and we all kind of know. We all gravitate to like-minded people in general. So we kind of pick our news outlets, but there's two different charts here, which I'm gonna pass around. And they kind of graphically interface how the media bias shakes out. But what's interesting, they're done by different organizations, so they put different organizations in different columns too. I guess most folks have the one that kind of looks like this, like a sine curve. And there's been a variety of these put out by a bunch of different organizations, but it goes to most extreme left, most extreme right, and then fact reporting analysis, and it kind of puts everybody on the same thing. But what's interesting is that horizontal media bias chart puts NPR just a little bit to the left in the middle. This other one, the all sides media basis chart, puts NPR solidly on the left side of the equation. So it's kind of interesting to see when I was looking down through the one, the horizontal, the vertical one, it has NBC and ABC and CBS slightly left of center. And they put CNN way over on the left. In the first chart, CNN is in the middle of skews left. And I've always said, actually, when you start out with newspapers, long before television and radio, there was no pretext of impartiality. You look at the names of all the papers here in Maine, it was the Republican Journal, No Way Advertising Democrat. I mean, they were actually started by political parties as house organs for their, and then I don't know how it kind of crept around to this, the whole notion of impartiality. So it's, I think everything has to be read, everything has to be watched, mindful of that. I think the one thing you can watch is, do they actually present other viewpoints other than theirs? I think it's more important than their particular bias and give other people's the quote. I think, you know, a lot of times now you're seeing the story, well, couldn't be reached for comment, couldn't be reached for comment. And a lot of that is nobody wants to talk to you because they know you're not going to do it right and you're not going to do it fair. So so these are just sort of self-explanatory for yourself. I agree with most of them. Some of them you can argue back and forth one way or the other. Like this, the vertical one puts Wall Street Journal in the center, and I put it to the right. You know, they must have a bias too. So, but it's these people produce these on a fairly regular basis. It's interesting to see how they shift and how they change in that respect. I've been droning on. If you have some questions, just jump right in. I think the local media landscape, you're going to see more fluff. One of the things, television is really, they can't call themselves news. And for the last decade, it's like if there's a fire or there's an accident, they actually used to send out a crew and go there. And now they show you the Google Earth map of where something happened. Well, so what? You know, I'm so tired of a news story, voice over a Google map. You know, and they probably haven't even got permission to use that. I look at News Center, the Portland station, the new weather people, always bugs my wife all the heck, is when they do the weather, they always stand in front of our part of the station. Because I'm talking about the weather.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, what do we chop liver? And we have family in Presque Isle. Yeah. We're always behind the person as far as that kind of stuff. But they have one weather person and she does it from her living room. You know, with a computer, it tells you what it's going to do. They don't have crews. Every TV station, every radio station had coverage on weekends. Yeah. There is no coverage on weekends. So I always tell, and friends of Katie, we always tried to break things on a Friday because that was going to run all weekend because there was no other news. So you're going to hit the cycle five or six times of that same story. The other thing we learned is, We laugh and we talk about the lack of people. One person would do a story and it was fun to see. It would start in a weekly, then the daily would catch it, then the TV people would pick up on it. Donna Gormley used to be anchor at Channel 2 in Bangor. She said, she was news director, and she said, we're going to go a week without looking at newspapers because we know what the news is. She said, they made it about 4 hours.
Wow.
And nobody knew what to cover. Nobody had written down, oh yeah, that trial's today or this sentence is now. Those kind of things. And so I developed a theory that there's one person in Maine writes all the news and they're grossly paid. And everybody else just steals it from them. Just steals the idea. When you see the Bangor Daily write a story of what, according to Village Soup or according to the Courier Gazette, you'd be fired. When I was an editor, you worked for me, if you quoted another news agency as your source, because we have no idea if that's true. And I'm not going to go on them. We're going to do our own reporting on that. But you see that over and over, that need for content, you know, if you provide that content. And then the other thing was, like, when I was at Friends of Acadia, now I'm on the other side of the coin. I'm trying to get the word out, and I'm trying to do it the most advantageous way. When the park came to me and they said, we've got a transportation plan, we're going to limit parking, we're going to require smaller buses, it's going to be, we're going to have reservations for Cadillac. How do we announce this without it being this big, huge controversy? And I said, first off, don't hold a big show hearing at the NDI High School, because then you give somebody a place to pick it out front when the news crews come, and it becomes a whole big show. So I suggested, that's what they did. I said, have individual meetings in every community's library where people can ask questions. It's a neutral forum. It's a calm and reasoned forum. And there's no protest opportunity kind of thing. That's exactly what they did. But then we wanted to get the story out. How do we do the first launch? And I said, whoever writes the story first sets the tone for that story for everybody else in the state, because everybody else copies on. And so we got a hold of A.J. Higgins, who's now retired and lived down in Korea. And I knew from when he was a cover reporter here on a motorcycle going to Bucksport and Winter Harbor the same day to cover a story. And we said, A.J., we're going to give you this first. And so we went over everything, because I knew he'd do a fair and impartial job, main public broadcasting. So he breaks the story. As he breaks it, we sent everybody the release, but we gave it to AJ early so he'd get it on there first. Everybody saw that, and they picked up on how he did it, and that's how they presented it. In a way, it's a manipulative tactic, but it's also acknowledgement of how that actually flows through the state. It was, you know, AJ went with the angle that, you know, plan to reduce traffic and congestion instead of saying, you're going to have to pay more to go up Cadillac starting next year, which could have been the angle that some other people were. Anyway, that's kind of it in a nutshell. I think, you know, I don't see it getting any better, because that way forward of how do you make money, maintain your staff, and do all that is still pretty difficult. You know, I think Reed Brower's papers are profitable. But then again, you know, the American and Islander were late this week because I had a press breakdown. At least those presses still run in this part of the state. Mm-hmm. Most everything else is printed down in Portland now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have other questions or anything about it. Yeah, we'll go around the room.
Well, the Bangor Daily News started to run a little nonprofit fundraising thing. And yeah. I know The Guardian now is not-for-profit too. I mean, mm-hmm. Do you think nonprofit news has a possibility to fill some of this?
The irony is that most of it's nonprofit now. It's right. Just that they're still filing a tax return because they're trying to make money.
Right.
So you know, that might be it, but
like the Maine Monitor, that's not for profit.
That's not for profit. Right. But they have to tin cup it also.
Yeah.
And at some point, I mean, I always send them some money and I know those folks pretty well. But at the same time, if they get into a crisis where their funding isn't there, you still can maybe sell your soul to the devil there. At least, you know, at least with the traditional advertising, you diversify your funding base so there's no one person. When I was working at the Barton Times, there was this huge, massive scandal at the First National Bank there. And it was quite a scandal. The U.S. officer, the controller of the currency, was investigating them. They were giving other officers and directors of the bank loans without applications. Mm-hmm. They were refinancing their houses as Freddie Mac mortgage limits went up without paperwork and based on phony appraisals. And they did all this kind of stuff. And I did a whole series of articles. And when I got the first one, I went to see the publisher. And I said, by the way, Don Allen, who owns a shopping center here and is your biggest advertiser at a full page every week, he's on the board of that bank. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee you he's probably going to pull his advertising if we do this. The publisher said, I think it's a big enough story, let's do it. So we did, and Don pulled his advertising for a short time. And after I figured he had to make a show of it because the other board of directors. And then I went to see him and I said, you know, Don, I said, I've got two editorials I'm going to run this week, and you can decide which one's going to run. I said, this one talks about something about Acadia National Park, and this one talks about how businesses are trying to hide the truth and make us pay a financial penalty because they don't want you to know what's going on in town. And you can decide which one of those is going to run. Mm-hmm. Then I came back. So you know, that's probably borderline unethical for the editor to go over and extort the big advertiser, but it's also real reality of life in a small town. Don and I remain good friends, you know, even after that. So, you know, we did the whole series of articles, and advertisers eventually came back, and we were proved right with a lot of the research that we did. So it's hard. You have to watch that. It is business. And then actually, when I came to the, I went, it's at the Barber Times, change of ownership. I went, worked at the American for 5 years, and then went back to the Barber Times for 10 years before we founded the Islander. And when I first started at the American for that 5 years, Lorenzo Creamer was a hotel guy down at Bar Harbor. He had the Golden Anchor, and he ran an Eagle cruise. And what he would do was he would take his boatload of passengers out to the island where the eagles are nesting, and then he'd whistle to them, and then he'd take out a hypodermic needle and inject the dead fish with air, and he'd throw it to them, and they'd fly down and get the fish next to the boat, and the boat would go like this because all the tourists would run to one side to get a picture. Well, that's imprinting eagles. They're endangered species at that time. And so I sent a reporter there undercover, and we did pictures and did a whole story. And then 6 months later, the legislature passed a law making it illegal to do those kinds of things with eagles. So Lorenzo wasn't too happy with me. And he had been advertising in the American because he wouldn't advertise in the Barber Times. And when I started at the American, he went in to see Alan Baker and said, any publication that employs Earl Breckland is not getting a dime from me. I'm pulling all my advertising. And Alan was, good, see you later. So, you know, it takes that intestinal fortitude on the part of publishers to say these things aren't important. Yeah. You know, and Alan and I were not anywhere near alike politically. But at the same time, he knew what was most important in journalism and wasn't afraid to do that. So I think that was pretty good. Carol?
I'm a avid reader of the Bangor Daily. I think it would be tragic to lose the Bangor Daily. And I see papers like Machias, and I think Callas was a Canadian corporation buying it. And then, I mean, I even subscribed for a year to see if there was any way of getting another point of view. And they're just, they buy those papers for a reason.
Yeah.
And so the death of the Bangor Daily, you've really announced, what can we do as supporters and subscribers? I mean, I don't pay enough. I pay $95 a year to get every single morning when I get up at 6 o'clock to have it there. Well, I love the letters to the editor, and I love the, I feel like it represents the second district,
yeah,
as best they can, but fairly. And so what do we do if, I mean, what are the alternatives for us as subscribers? If we, I just think everybody should send them $95 a year and subscribe, right, even if you never read it, just right, to support them.
Roxy and I subscribe. You know, one of the things Horace Greeley once said as far as delivery of newspapers, and it was all newspaper boys back then, and he said, never in history has such a titanic enterprise rested entirely on the early rising habits of small boys.
And girls, know, I had a daughter who was.
And I was a paper kid, you know, when I was the hard part there is now, like, the drivers are independent contractors. So they make them buy those plastic bags. If you get your paper soaked and wet because they didn't put a bag on it, it's because the drivers have to buy that out of their money, and they have to pay the higher gas prices. So, you know, we had horrible delivery problems, and I'm going, and they just never address it, because they had four open routes and they paid one guy to do four routes because it was easier for the district manager to solve this problem that way. But then we weren't getting it till 10 in the morning. And then it's kind of worthless to you, kind of, you don't mind if a person has a breakdown or something, vehicle breakdown. So I think with the Bangor Daily, you have to, subscribing is the key. I think they don't have to be lazy about what they're doing though. You know, they did a great series about sexual harassment in the military and the National Guard. Yeah. And that, some of those, when they went to four pages long, it's way too much gray. I don't know anybody's going to read the whole long, long, long. Because without proper editorship, so many stories are the writer showing off what they know, not actually telling the story. And so they need to pay some closer attention. And I think what someone has to know more what their reporters are doing, and who's covering what and why they're doing it. And so they need more oversight, I think, in their main office in Bangor, which they just rent a small office up there now. They still own the weeklies in Northern Maine. It's you know, Presque Isle paper, the Caribou paper, the Holton paper, the Scattered Observer. Just before I left the Islander, Alan Baker was on this national commission that was doing hearings on the future of newspapers in America, and USA Today, the New York Times, Los Angeles Register, and Alan represented weekly newspapers, and they would meet New York once a month and bring in experts from around the world. And they basically said, you'll see more and more consolidation of daily papers, and that weeklies and strong communities will thrive as long as there's newsprint, because they provide content that nobody else does. So I think the Bangor Daily just has to be careful about what they cover. And I really think they need to change the printing schedule or get printed closer to, because it's just not relevant if they don't have yesterday's stuffing.
When you say newsprint, is my digital copy a newsprint?
No.
No. So,
So you get a digital copy. You don't get the actual hard copy.
So the future is only in hard copy papers?
For weeklies, because people spend more time with that.
Oh, I see.
Daily papers may go to more online version. And that's hard. And you have, there's a fellow down on the island, Lincoln Milstein, who's a retired guy. But every time he publishes something and he rushes to publish it, in the next 10 minutes, there's four corrections that follow it, because he doesn't do his homework. Mm-hmm. So he's hurting his own credibility, and he really goes after people. He's sort of a gaslight. So I think he likes that. He was with the New York Times organization. I think he likes that. Wall Street Journal. I think he likes to tell people, you know, that he's kicking some ass and stirring the pot in a small town in Maine, but I'm not impressed. And of course, I'm on the planning board now in Bar Harbor. It's one of the things that I just did for some community service. It had been a couple of years since I had a job, and knew how to do better than me, so I just kind of missed it. And I won't return his calls, just because he's never going to get it right, and he's always got an agenda. So, and that's hard, because that makes people trust the media less. I really don't know what the answer is for the Bangor Daily News. You know, I've talked to Lisa DeSisto, the woman I mentioned, who runs Reed Brower's papers, and they have Troy Bennett. Bangor Daily has Troy Bennett, who covers Portland, takes a lot of pictures. He writes stories about tattoo artists and a lot of kind of more popular culture things, because they wanted to try to get some advertising from that market. And I think one of the interesting things is that if the Bangor Daily wants to really penetrate those markets, it's going to have to hire more reporters. It's going to have a bureau down there, maybe a section of that news. And it's going to be very expensive. But if the Bangor Daily was to go away, the Portland papers could put a bureau in Bangor, a bureau in Ellsmere, you know, one or two reporters, and actually become more of a statewide paper pretty easily and pretty inexpensively. So I don't think a vacuum is going to would last for long if the Bangor Daily goes belly up. Mm-hmm. But every day it's late, I wonder it's because the day cease operation, and I wouldn't be surprised. I think it's that close to the wire with that.
What do you think about the large papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post going over to doing video segments on their online presentations?
I think that makes great sense for them. I subscribe to the New York Times online, and I think once you do that, their revenue now from their digital subscribers exceeds their print subscribers. So they have more subscribers and more revenue from digital now. I think that it's all about the clicks, and that's what the advertisers want to see, and about harvesting the data that they can then sell to advertisers. Go ahead. So the more clicks they can get, and they understand the world, everybody wants to see video. You know, I went three or four times, watched some video of some guy setting off fireworks, and one went in the back of his car where he had all his fireworks and made quite a show. So, you know, it's clickbait, basically, but that's what the name of the game is. But they're still doing really good journalism and really good perspective, and so that you kind of can't get anywhere else. And I go to Somerville and pick up the Maine Sunday Telegram, because they had a route for a while. Same guy never got the Bangor Daily here on time. That paper stopped coming until 3 p.m. on Sunday. So now I just go buy it at the Somerville One Stop every Sunday. But the Boston Globe and the New York Times are there. So you know, they've used, say, Reed Brower's network and those delivery networks to piggyback and contract to get those around. So they're finding workarounds for all these things. But it's not easy. It's just not the same. My wife loves the digital edition of the Islander because she sits there and gets an ink on her hands. She likes that. I still like the physical paper.
Me too.
So, and she laughs when I'm reading the Bangor Daily and I crease it so it folds flat. Drink it with my coffee. Yes.
Have you thought about doing something similar to what the Quiet Side Journal tries to do?
What I wanted to write about and what I pitched them in my column is I think there's some bigger stories about individuals that just aren't getting covered, about you know, what happens to people. One of the things I think any news organization, and I pitch it to the Maine Monitor people, this whole flagpole charade down the east is, you know, the whole Worcester Reef thing.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't go up against that. When Bar Harbor had that Christmas tree in the park, which thank God the council said we'll try for 6 months. It was an advertisement for Worcester Reef Company, but it's for the veterans. And so Bar Harbor said, no, we're not going to renew it. Get rid of it. And Jesse Waters and the whole Fox News came down there and did three or four stories about the town that hates Christmas. And Ruth Evelyn, who was chair of the council then, the town librarian, is coming out of the bank on her lunch hour and got ambushed by Jesse Waters going, why does your town hate Christmas? And what do you have against Jesus? And all of it's like, why? You know, we got 100 churches, Santa comes to town, we decorate, you know, we make a big deal out of Christmas thing. And the Worcesters were behind all of that. And when you look at the 990s for those two things, and that's the other thing, I don't know how many reporters may not have read a 990 of a nonprofit organization, that 990, every nonprofit has to file a 990 every year that says, who are your directors, where your money comes from, where your money goes to, and if you have employees that make over a certain amount, that has to be listed. And it's all of the Worcester Wreath, and then you have Wreaths Across America. All of the people on the Wreaths Across America board are members of the Worcester family. Their sole source of wreaths for Wreaths Across America is the Worcester Wreath Company. So it's a huge Ponzi scheme for them to sell wreaths. Now, these are the same people that want to build the billion-dollar flagpole mile high down in Columbia Falls. People are, you know, people that can't afford it are sending them $5 in donations, and they're going to put a monument, every name of every soldier who ever died in any American war is going to be on monuments there. This whole thing, and it's a total charade, because you know they're all going to be on that board and taking salaries and making money.
And all those migrant workers,
yeah,
that are picked up by vans that come to Columbia Falls, and Mono and all the Quakers, we gather food, I mean, yeah, food and linens and boots and shoes. They arrive from Florida with no coats in October, and they are given a bunk bed with a mattress with no linens, no blanket. They arrive totally, and they have to pay part of their salary in order to have been picked up in Florida and brought up and delivered.
Yeah.
It's atrocious that people are trying to close them and care for them, and they're going to build a flagpole. It's absolutely atrocious.
So when they took the tree out of Bar Harbor, they had the Patriot Riders, which I'm sure only fly Trump flags now. They came to escort the tree back to Columbia Falls and made this whole show of it. And it was just horrifying me that all these organizations all over the country pay Wreaths Across America for the wreaths they put in cemeteries. Yeah. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, the whole Arlington thing, it's very moving. But it's all
money.
They pay Wreaths Across America, they pay Worcester Wreath Company, and they're just lining their pockets.
Yeah. Right. And they pretend to be nonprofit, and they are definitely
nonprofit
on the backs of people who, you know, are being treated unfairly.
The Worcester Wreath Company is a private company, so those financials aren't public. You'd have to subpoena those if you're saying.
Where are the Worcesters? They're not local Worcesters.
No, they're all West down Harbor, in Richias and Cherryfield, that area. You know.
Well, it's really,
that's a huge scandal that somebody, if
so
they dug
you,
into
did
it,
you pitch that story?
I did to the Maine Monitor.
Are you
going to
do it?
Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't want to do it.
You want them to do it?
I mean, you know, I guess if it got me mad enough, maybe it would do it. Yeah.
I mean, I talked to somebody who says, you know, they live in down in near Washington, D.C. My father is buried in what is it, the cemetery where the, and he always gets a wreath on every year. And I don't, he says, I think it's very generous. I said, well, I think it's terrible that you don't find out why you're getting a wreath every year.
Well, and that's what, I mean, like I said, people are sending in that they're going to build this whole $1 billion flagpole, which, you know, it's just like some of the, what I call the echo extortion that happened over at Schoodick when, you know, somebody announced they're going to build 4 hotels and a golf course, and all of a sudden everybody had to raise $30 million to buy it and save the land. They just had some architects sit down and spend two hours making some fancy drawings and then got triple the price for the land because everybody was all worried about that. And so that's the same thing with this. There's nobody, I'll guarantee you, nobody's done any actual engineering on how to build a mile-high flagpole that looks like what they're talking about. It looks like something my grandkids would do with Legos. And, you know, so it's all just a pipe. Yes.
Well, another major issue around here is the aquaculture endeavors from big, big, huge things like in Princeton State. I mean, I think that Whiteside Journal did seem to cover that pretty well.
Well, you know, he did. I'll give him credit. He breaks stuff. He breaks stories, but he often has it wrong, and so they have to kind of go back. Yeah, there was a big salmon die off over there in Blue Hill Bay, which nobody else had done anything on until he finally did it. Again, is that one person's underpaid, they're grossly underpaid, and they write all the news. That's how it got elevated to the regular media actually trying to report on some of that. So, I mean, there is some value in that, I suppose. But that's what you have when you have a vacuum, when you don't have other organizations. When I was at the paper, we had Lori Schreiber doing fisheries, and she was covering all those kinds of things. She does a good job now writing for the Working Waterfront. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting, when I was at Courier Publication, they had 9 papers, we had 9 editors. It's like, now here we are 20 years later, and we've got you know, Tom Groney, who was editor of Belfast at the time, he's running the Working Waterfront. And, you know, AJ's retired. You kind of see how people sort of filter out through the state, the same people that have been trusted sources and still care about that stuff. But then there's a lot of people that, you know, just don't know what they're doing.
I think you're asking things, but I've noticed that Susan Young, who's the opinion editor, editorial editor for the Bangor Daily, started having op-eds in the, for now. In the paper. Does that mean, is that significant in terms of?
I just think that they figured, you know, they wanted more locally produced ones, because almost everything, you know, those, almost every column in the Bangor Daily on that right hand page is stuff that they just go get off people's websites or get submitted to every paper in the country when it's not a main person that's written. So it's all, some of it's, there was a paper out west that was in St. Louis, Missouri. There were 2 dailies, and they were having a big fight for circulation, each trying to get the best of the other. And so one of the editors said, it's the famous dead cat in the Cornhill story. And he said, well, we're going to make up a letter to the editor and put it in our paper and say the best way to get your corn to grow really high is to put a dead cat in every hill where you plant your corn. And so they did. And then all the cat lovers wrote in, oh, this is so horrible. And then all the cat haters responded. And this is before social media, and their circulation went up about 30% because everybody was following the dead cat in the Cornhill scandal. So, you know, there's some of that. So they will sometimes pick their opinion pieces on what they can generate for comments. And then the Bangor Daily has those hateful commentators. They don't put them on the editorial page. It's interesting, they put their online comments on their editorial page, but they don't put the most hateful ones there.
Well, that's nice.
But the other thing I hate is when they put online comments about stories that appeared online, they print it in the paper, but they haven't put the story in the paper yet. So they're all commenting about some story you haven't seen.
Yeah. And the Tom Groening, the Working Waterfront, is now being published or being sent out with the Bangor Daily. Did you know that?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, and then they print and publish 50,000 issue. And so they're putting about 20,000. They put it in the Bangor Daily. They just had me write a column, which will be out in the next issue, about NBI's love-hate relationship with cars over the last 100 years. Yeah. I did a little piece for them on that. But they actually provide some great news of that. You know, that there's a vacuum there that other papers say aren't doing, say, especially in the Midcoast. But then see, Alan Baker would get mad at them because he said they're a nonprofit, they don't pay taxes, but they're selling advertising, competing against the papers that have to pay taxes. I always just said, hey, well, if you don't have the stuff in your paper to make people want to advertise in it, I don't care whether you're profit or nonprofit. Yes.
So the Medill School at Northwestern has been trying to make the link between the demise of local papers, the demise of local investigative reporting, and the demise of democracy. Like, how can we govern ourselves if we don't know the bad stuff that's going on? And
yeah.
Who's following the bad stuff that's going on in some of these towns that don't have the paper?
Well, part of it is that when staffs got smaller, instead of you saying, what's the story here? And getting the it isn't just two sides, but getting the right number of voices to explain that story, reporters got lazy just because they had to, because they're just so overworked, and just say, I got one person for and one person against. And I would get, and they make no attempt to the veracity of what those people say. And they're abrogating their responsibility as journalists when they just think just getting what they said in the paper means I'm doing an impartial job, because a lot of times it's total folderol that you're publishing. And, you know, I would get letters to the editor that had assertions of fact that I knew were just patently wrong. And I would send it back to him and I said, as long as you're going to say that, I'm not going to print your letter. Oh, it's censorship. No, I said, no, it's editorship. Yeah. Censorship's when the government says you can't publish something. I'm saying I'm happy to publish your letter, but I believe that to be a false statement. And I don't want to use the word lie, but it's not factual. So you need to change that. You're welcome to your opinion, and don't just label something saying, in my opinion, and then state a fact, because that doesn't make it a fact. And, you know, sometimes people got mad at me, and I didn't allow any personal attacks either. No one had a right on the pages to say someone else didn't have a right to speak. You can disagree with them, but you can't say, you know, they don't have a right to say that. So, and now that's what it is, you know, it's un-American. It's, yeah, but that's because the public has no way. I mean, Walter Cronkite filtered stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Granted, it was all one mind. There are only three networks. We all watch the same three network shows. We all watch Gunsmoke or whatever, you know, Laugh-In or whatever. So we had a commonality of culture then that we don't have now. Now we're fragmented and everyone's in their corner, everyone's in their niche. They're not exposed to other ideas. They don't have to tolerate other ideas. And we don't have that common frame of reference to even have a conversation. Because if you want to use an allegory related to a television show or a movie or something, people don't know. So that makes it difficult too. Yes.
Yeah, what I've noticed too is that with just the simultaneity of so many blogs and so much opinion, and we also lose out on the cycles and the, you know, the way information travels.
Yeah.
And so there's less, I don't know, sense of consequence and investment, I think. Just, it's just too much to grasp.
Yeah, it is.
So I feel like that's where I really miss the power of the small newspapers.
Yeah. You
know, papers, because they're in time and space, you know.
Right.
And I even noticed a trend of, you know, missing dates now in papers, because they're just like,
yeah,
this is the news for now, for in turn, you know, indefinitely.
No deadlines.
Right. And
yeah.
So I think, I don't know, it's really problematic.
Yeah. It's, and again, that's just, there's no editors there. So it's, how do people know when this happened, or how, yeah, you know, what context is this? Or, and then they don't have that institutional knowledge of, well, this happened 5 years ago, or this is how this was handled before. So, you know, some people go into a situation and think, oh my God, this is the first thing. No, it's not. It's probably not even news. You know, I always said people doing what they're supposed to be isn't news. People, you know, what they're not supposed to be often is news. It's hard to necessarily define. It's the old man bites dog, that's news. Dog bites man, maybe, if it's really bad. You know, so,
yeah, and that's where you see the Guardian, you know, this is a year old, this is 3 months old. It's so important.
Yeah, just that context. And that's one thing, Bangor Daily sometimes will run stories that you've seen everywhere else for quite a while, because they're just trying to fill the page. And the other thing, I don't mean to keep picking on them, but you'll see the same story in two different places in the newspaper, because this person is filling that page and this person is filling that page, and they don't talk. And then nobody else looks at the whole thing before it goes out the door. So, yes.
Be interested in your thoughts on the cause of this lack of commonality. Do you think, to what extent do you think it was pushed on the population from the media? And to what extent do you think it's just, this is something that people have chosen to do and the media is feeding them what they're asking for?
I think the media is feeding them what they're asking for, and people just were so enamored with different media, whether it's television, video games, radio, the internet. You know, you have that immediate relationship with that screen right in front of your face. I always say, you know, with the definition of mass shooting is four people or more shot. And what happens now is, because every single one of those is right blaring first thing on the news, that skews you to think the whole world is, every corner is having those kind of shootings, when in some periods they're actually fewer than the previous year. But because of that impact, and then you feel that you have that adrenaline rush, you have that visceral reaction to it as if it happened in front of you, even though it has no connection. So you feel less safe, you feel less secure. So I think people, the money followed people's interests into this fragmentation of media. And part of it is, you know, nobody from the Proud Boys would have got airtime. You know, the internet allows people of warped political views to kind of consolidate and believe they're part of a majority rather than a lone wolf kind of a thing. And that emboldens them, and it makes everybody thinks they're normal. So they think everything I think and everything I do, that the whole world does that. But that is far, far from the case.
What do you think? We were having a discussion in the group about the Ellsworth American following what John Lenihan is up to. And we wondered if they were being quiet about him because they didn't want to draw attention to him. Or is it their job to draw attention to him because he is a player?
You know, that's interesting. I don't think they're making any decisions that they don't want to give him attention. That would be a pretty big breach of etiquette if it's either newsworthy, it's not newsworthy. We don't say, well, we're not going to cover Lenihan because we don't want him to get a big head or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, the guy makes news just because people are interested and does some crazy stuff. And I think that, I think as the years have gone on, there's a greater understanding of the actual, you know, size of his influence or what have you, that maybe everything he does doesn't get as many, as much attention. I personally would be keeping an eye on him every minute just because I don't trust him. You know, he's showed himself with those consumer rights cases, and some of those predatory practices of what he's done. And again, he's not building a $1 billion flagpole, but he's got his Constitution Hall. And anybody that wraps themselves in the flag like that, I don't trust.
Back to that issue, there's been one assessment that he's bought some very expensive ads in the Ellsworth American recently,
yeah,
for Constitution Hall. And what do you do about that if you were Cindy Burke or whoever the assessment manager is?
Well, I think.
And you haven't done a story on him since January.
So they haven't written anything about him since January.
Not that I've seen. And I know right now, as a candidate for the main house, plus he is going to every single school board hearing in Ellsworth and raising all kinds of the national talking points of the Republicans to say CRT and anti-trans and all that stuff is just going into every single school board meeting.
Before you answer that, I just want to reflect back on the Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump election. And there were a couple of days that fall that I took a picture of the front page of the New York Times. And Trump was on the front page of the New York Times 6 times in one day, and Clinton was not there at all.
Yeah.
And that happened over and over and over again. And so when you answer the question about covering Lenihan, you know, reflect on that at the same time.
Well, it's interesting. When I was with the organization, the Islander and the American, he ran a full page color every week in both papers about finding Jesus.
Okay.
And you know, he was an advertiser. Of course, that ownership I knew didn't care if there was a news story, we were going to do it, whether the person was an advertiser or not. I think now they realize that's as much a publicity stunt And so I think the things you bring up, that somebody needs to bring to their attention, where they don't have reporters at all these meetings now like they used to. Usually a reporter covers a certain amount of towns. I went to the school board, went to the selectmen, went to the council. It's just say, hey, you know, Lenny has been going to all these meetings and he's been doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't know if there's a story there, but I think people might find it interesting. At least it gives them some questions to ask him when they do their candidate interviews, which hopefully they'll do.
Well, I just want, in case people don't know, I mean, Lenahan goes to the city council meetings. I watch him on Facebook. And he's been advocating, and he has an organization to oppose the school budget, which is going to be on the ballot this coming week.
Right.
And he's, and that's, well, I think that's been one of his ads in Ellsworth American. I mean, he's got an organized effort to oppose the school budget. That ought to be in the paper, and I feel guilty that I was going to write a letter to the editor, and I didn't, but it's too late now.
But, you know, I mean, we did that story, we did that show on newspapers, right? And the Democracy Forum, and what every single one of those people said is, if you've got a story, call the editor with a tip. They're all looking for stories.
Well, I do think it's covered. I mean, I met the guy in Ellsworth, who's a new reporter, and does cover those things.
But see, you also get some reporters telling new to town doesn't know Lenahan's 40-year history of the Mosby thing, you know, that DVD sent out when he was running that time. I mean, you know, Roxy and I, you know, honestly, second only to Lenahan and stuff in our mailboxes and flyers was Nicole, you know, who, you know, it's like when the person came out and says, yeah, we're going to vote for it. You know, like, you know, please can you cut down on the flyers? You know, they, you know, they get the money, they want to use it. And all that kind of stuff. So, you know, with Lenahan, I think it's probably emblematic of the fact that they don't see him as big a player, but they need to let people know what he's doing, because maybe you say, well, if he's trying to marshal his forces, I may want to make sure I get out there to go support the school. But, you know, you as a candidate, it's hard, because if you call them, you know, they're going to say, oh,
you're not raised,
right? Yeah, but then have a friend do it. Just say, hey, look, you guys, you realize he's running for office and he's trying to get rid of the local school budget and he's trying to do all this crazy stuff. And I didn't know if that was something worthy of some coverage. So you call the editor, you know, a lot of times you cover, call a reporter, they're going to, if they know they got their 40 hours and they can do it at these three meetings and go into the police station on Tuesday, that's how they structure the week. You know, if there's one that's going to make six phone calls and maybe got to go to a couple of meetings, and they're not so much, because they're also getting pressure to keep their story count up and stuff like that. When Letitia Baldwin does a wonderful job at the American, when she left the Bar of Times and went to the Bangor Daily, the teacher said, well, you know, they gave it the Bangor Daily, it's how little can you do and still get paid. So we tracked on a grease board in our conference room how many stories Letitia did each week for the first 6 months she was there. And she started out, she was doing like 27 things and pictures a week. And by the end of that 6 months, she was down to three.
Whoa.
Because, you know, people, and maybe, you know, she's probably spent 3 days working on a feature. I'm not saying she's goal-breaking, but, you know, that was what she was interested in. There was nobody telling her, well, maybe you need to do this story, maybe you need to do that story. So there's some of that, not enough supervision.
Well, this was great, Earl. Yeah. Thank you so much.